It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
To another BritBlitz.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is filmmaker Mikey Murray. Welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Now, we're here to talk about two things: your new movie, Mindset, and three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. Is that correct? Is that why you're here?
That is, well, I believe that's why I'm here, and that's what I'm all prepped for, so let's do it.
Good. Well, let's start off with your film, Mindset, then. Just to give people the basic understanding of what it is, you want to give us a brief synopsis as to what Mindset is all about?
Yes, Mindset is about a failed actress called Lucy, who is living in a relationship with her screenwriter boyfriend. They live in a house in Lincoln, and they have a bit of a dysfunctional relationship.
Right.
To the point where Lucy decides that she thinks she might want to have an affair with someone else from work.
Oh. And what genre is that?
It's a comedy drama.
Okay.
It's kind of a throwback to a 60s new wave British film, kitchen sink kind of style, with a modern twist, I guess.
Okay. And did you wrote and directed this, yeah?
I wrote, directed, and produced.
Produced. But so thinking as you the writer and director then, from a writing point of view, what was the kernel of an idea that sort of kick-started off this film that we now see today?
Okay, so there was two things. I knew I needed to write something that was really low budget because I'd been skirting around the industry for a while trying to get a feature made on a higher budget. I'd won sort of festival awards with shorts, and I'd won a Scottish BAFTAs for best first-time writer. Mm. And so there was a bit of interest in projects. I'd been working with production companies, but I just couldn't get anything, greenlit, basically. It's that age-old thing, you can't get a film made until you've got a film made, as it were. So I thought, right, well, you know what, I've been spending too much time trying to get these other projects made. I just need to write something that I can make myself on the budget that I have and for the resources that I have. So that's what I did. I kind of set out to write this story that, could be done with what I had. And the resources I had were my house, and a few other locations around about where I live, a little bit of money, which I felt I could raise about 20,000 to shoot it with, just through friends and family, and the way that I decided to do it, which was that I was going to break it into 100 shares, sell 50 of those to investors, give the other 50 to cast and crew. So I'd worked out all that stuff first. So then the script just kind of, then I had to come up with an idea. And the idea, I'd kind of had an idea in my mind about a screenwriter and actor who were living together in a really dysfunctional relationship. I didn't know where I was going to take that yet. Thematically, I wanted to write something about how disillusioned I felt after Brexit, and how, just society now is generally forcing us into our households and making us not want to go outside because we're afraid of what's out there, in a sense. So that started to create this notion of, right, well, here's this actor who's no longer acting, and she is working in an office job to make ends meet. And she's living with a screenwriter who hasn't managed to get anything made or written potentially for a long time.
Yeah.
So it was not too dissimilar to my life, shall we say, but it's not, I mean, it's not an autobiographical film. It's not about me. It's about elements of me. It's about elements of things that piss me off. It's about elements of other people's lives that I've spoken to. So, yeah. When I'm writing, I usually start with theme. I usually start with what am I pissed off about at the moment? And that usually I form the ending of my film and the thing that I want to say before I start anything else.
Okay.
I know that a lot of writers don't work that way. Most writers work from concept or from character, but I work from theme. I find that's the easiest and most economical way for me to write screenplays. So
I can go either or. I like theme to emerge and be surprised, but equally, if I'm pissed off or angry about something, I can really sort of drive at that one, and it can be quite productive that way because you kind of know what you're trying to look for as opposed to looking for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, given you've mentioned low budget a few times, and you put a figure on it, people might be surprised to see names like Jason Isaacs and Steve Oram, who's been on the podcast himself before when he did his film
which is amazing, by the way. That film's nuts.
It is indeed. Yeah. So from a kind of low budget filmmaker point of view, how do you get a film like this into those type of people's hands?
Okay, so I'd met Steve because of it happens. I noticed that his production company was called Lincoln Studios, and I was quite interested by that because I'd just moved to Lincoln, and I thought, is he in Lincoln or what's the crack? So I looked at his website, and it's clearly just this piss take about that's got this fake character who owns a sunbed parlor, but he's also breaking out into the movies, and it's kind of like Steve's alter ego, basically. Right. So I just dropped him an email and said, you know, what's the crack? Why did you call it Lincoln Studios? Are you connected to Lincoln and that? And he responded and was like, no, I just thought it was a bit of a gag. I thought Lincoln was a sort of everyman town. I liked the idea of it. And I was like, cool, would you like to come up and speak to our students? Because I run a British film night and I'll show Sightseers. Why don't you come up and talk to them about the making of Sightseers? So he did. And then I found out that he was just putting the finishing touches on at the time. So I also run a film festival called Indie Links in Lincoln, which is all about sort of showing real proper indie films to our audience here, because we don't get a lot of that in Lincoln. So I started this festival. So I said to Steve, you know, why don't we show as a special event on a Friday night, and you can come up and talk. And he was like, great, I'll do that. So just through sort of bringing him in to speak to students, and then I brought him in again to speak to our students, and we started to kind of build a rapport, I guess. And then he was speaking at our festival. I had another actress who's Ailish Cahill, who's the lead in my film. They did an actors panel together where they were just discussing how to get them interested in your projects, basically. And they were saying, like, it's all about the script. We like a really good script. If we know it's written for us and, you know, it's kind of, and it's good, there's chances are we'll want to do it, you know? So I think I was the only person in the room who was listening, despite the fact that I was hosting the talk. And so I just went off and thought, right, this script that I'm about to embark on, I'm going to write it for them. So I wrote it for them. I didn't tell them I was writing it for them. I finished it and I sent it to Steve and Ailish and said, you know, do you want to read the script I've written just to see what you think about it? And they both came back and said, this is great. What are you doing with it? And I was like, I'm making it in the summer with both of you. So, and they were like, yeah, cool. And Steve was like, yeah, we'll get in touch with my agent. I think I'm quite busy in the summer, but get in touch with my agent. I'm up for it if I'm free, basically. And I spoke to his agent and she said, you know, I can give you a week. And I was like, oh, that might be tight, but we worked out our schedule. I had Ailish for 11 days, I had Steve for 7, and we shot it in 11 days. So
blimey, O'Reilly, that's aggressive.
Yeah, it was. And you know, we only had one day where we went over the sort of allotted time.
Yeah.
And we were working, you know, quite sustainably. So we were shooting during the day with mostly daylight. We did have lights. We were sort of enhancing it here and there, but it was mostly shot during daylight in June, so it was the best time of year to be filming for natural light. So,
what would be lessons learned that you from that kind of aggressive shoot that you could pass on to someone who's sort of got a similar challenge ahead of them? What would be some advice you could pass on?
I mean, you just have to be scheduled within an inch of your life, you know. I mean, my co-producer, Daz, like, we sat down together and really scheduled the hell out of the script. You know, we kind of got the script and I worked out, yes, it could be done in 11 days, but it was intricate. I mean, we didn't shoot sequentially. I know that most people don't, but we simply couldn't do it sequentially because we had our sort of co-star, Peter Bancoli, as well. We only had him for 4 days, so we had to do all of his stuff in the first 4 days. And then we had one day where he and Steve had to cross over because they had a couple of scenes together. So that was our fourth day. Then Peter was out of the picture. We didn't have him anymore. And then we were working with Steve for the next 6 days with Eilish. And then the last sort of 3 days, we just had Eilish on her own and we did all the stuff because she's the lead. There's quite a lot of things that she does in the script where she's by herself. So, and scheduling is everything, basically.
What do you remember being the most sort of challenge on paper? What was the most challenging sort of scene or sequence? And in a sense of what gave you the greatest sort of pleasure having done it? Also, what was the hardest, but what was perceived to be? And then, when you got over that hump, as it were, there was like...
I think the hardest bit of the shoot was just getting started with it. I mean, I've made a few films now, mostly shorts, and it's always that first day is getting through that first day and realizing that you aren't going to get that much. And I mean, and again, going back to the scheduling thing, you always want to schedule your easiest day as your first day, and not give yourself too much to achieve on that first day.
Because
it does take the whole crew a bit of time to get into the swing of like what's expected of them. It's the same if you start a new job, right? You
know? Yeah.
Like for that first week, you're just all at sea, and it's the same on a shoot. Like the first day, everyone's kind of looking at each other going, right, well, how is this going to work? And it takes to maybe day two or day three before you start working like a family and you know, getting it together. In terms of the most pleasing moment of the shoot for me, there's a scene in the film where Steve Oram and Eilish Cahill dance together, and it's kind of like this crucial scene that's the beginning of the third act, in a sense.
Yeah.
And I had a very particular song that I thought, I mean, this is fatal. This would be another piece of advice that I would always give filmmakers is don't have a particular song in mind when you... but I did, and I played it on the set for them while they were dancing.
Right.
And then without, I didn't have the rights to the song yet. And I checked how much it might cost me. And we ended up, we did get the rights to it. And it so it wasn't it was a recorded song by Marshall Tucker Band, who are a relatively well-known southern rock band from the US from the 70s.
Right.
But the song I wanted to use is not that kind of famous as such, so I kind of thought I could probably go to them and make them an offer for it and they'd probably say yes, and that is what happened. So
okay.
But it took about a year to get the rights nailed down for it.
Well, no, I mean, I interviewed Julia DeCorno about Tatane, and she actually wrote the songs into the script, because she was basically saying to a producer that the lyrics of this song are actually helping the narrative. This isn't just about I like this song. It's actually doing some heavy lifting for the story. So it was kind of a bit of a producer's nightmare in that sense.
Yeah, that is a total nightmare. You know, I mean, you've always got to be willing to walk away from a song, you know, and I've always said to, you know, I teach film as well, and I always say to students, do not write specific songs into your screenplay because you're just encouraging your producer to go, we can't make this because, you know, they're going to want to have that song and it's going to be too expensive, you know.
Now, going back to your point, you said about your film being a throwback to kind of 60s realism and all that kind of, and kitchen sink. You've shot this in black and white.
We didn't shoot it in black and white. We shot it in color.
But it is a black and white film, yeah.
It's a black and white film with color elements.
Oh, okay, so I mean, I've not seen all the film. So, So when, I was just going to ask, what was your conversations like with Jack Shelbourne then about sort of that? Or was the black and white a decision after shooting it, or was it before, or was it always going to be black and white?
Yeah, there is a story behind this. So
go on.
I'm not the filmmaker who makes black and white films. I'm not that guy, basically, right? Because I've always kind of thought, oh, well, it's classically art house and people do it for, like, they do it to make a statement kind of thing. So I'd never envisaged that it would be black and white. We shot it in color, we edited it in color, and we had a beautiful grade on it. John Holmes is the guy who did the grade on it. He's my colleague. And then Jack shot it for color. And we were relatively happy with it. But just, I had a last minute wobble where I just kind of thought, right, well, this was always supposed to be a bit of a 60s throwback movie, and it's not quite got that. And I'd come at a really busy time at work, so it was the first time in like maybe 6 months that I'd had a real moment of time to myself where I could watch the cut and really think about it. Because I didn't cut it. My friend Matt Owen cut the film as well. I don't edit my own work. But then I just had this wobble at the last minute, and I said to Jack and John and Matt, I said, I think this needs to be in black and white. And I thought John was going to take a shit because he'd spent so much time doing this beautiful grade on it,
yeah,
and color work. But he turned around and just went, I think you're right. He said, I think this will look a lot better.
What in particular made you come to that conclusion?
I just needed it. I think the rawness of the story, and also this notion that I wanted it to be this throwback movie. And I think that it's more clearly a throwback in black and white.
Yeah.
But it also works for the performances, I think. I think when you see it in colour and you see it in black and white, and that's no disparaging comment on the performances in it, because the performances are phenomenal. Steve Oram and Eilish Cahill are both amazing. But in black and white, it really helps you focus on those performances more. So I think it feels more... And the house feels tighter in black and white, for sure.
Well, I mean, it does wonders, doesn't it, for production values? Because there's not as much to worry about, is there? I mean, no, you shot it in colour, but once you go black and white, there's things that just aren't going to be seen as much as.
I mean, it created a couple of problems because obviously Jack had lit it for colour.
Okay.
So when we there's a scene towards the end where it was clearly morning when it was in colour because of the daylight that was coming in through the window.
Right.
And when we put it in black and white, it suddenly became less clear.
Ah, okay.
That it was morning. So we had to fix that with sound. So we added in a cuckoo of a dove.
Good to know.
To just make it clear that it was morning, you know.
Well, you've mentioned Matt already working on the edit. What were some of the story discoveries that you made in the edit that weren't evident when you were writing the script?
Not that many, I don't know. I don't think we discovered that much about the story. I mean, because we'd shot it in 11 days, it was tight anyway.
Right.
So Matt's first rough cut was an hour and 45.
Okay.
And it ended up being 90 minutes. So it was really just tightening up. I can't think if we actually moved anything around. We did cut a scene that was kind of full of exposition. As a screenwriter, you always write these scenes where characters get together and they explain their past and stuff. But we realized pretty quickly that we didn't need that scene. So we cut that and we kind of turned it into a sort of short montage sequence instead.
But that's good to know. I mean, from screenwriters listening in, that's an interesting thing to learn, you know, because you're right, you can't help yourself sometimes that you feel like you need to have your characters explain some things. But then when you're able to watch a film, there's so much codifying information you can take while you're watching a film that then the context of that scene where everyone does their exposition no longer matters.
Yeah, exactly. So the lead character sort of explained where she was from and sort of, because she's American.
Yeah.
So I kind of thought, well, it's a bit odd that this American's living in Lincoln kind of thing. So maybe I need to explain this in the script so that people who are reading it kind of understand. But then when you're watching your cut, you kind of go, well, it doesn't matter. People are smart. They'll just go, cool, she's an American living in Lincoln.
Yeah.
Who cares? You know? So it's like
it's a classic screenwriter question, though, isn't it? It's like, I wonder why she lives it. I mean, you would want to know that just for your own sort of story beats and stuff. But actually, does the film need to explain it? Because Americans have lived in Lincoln before.
Yeah, well, absolutely, and it's kind of like, and she's, you know, there's this just through knowing that she's a failed actor, which she kind of, I mean, that's a bit of a spoiler. You don't find that out until a bit later in the script, but and she's living with a screenwriter. It kind of makes sense, you know? Like they've probably met on some low budget film, or they've met at uni, you know.
Exactly.
And some of that stuff just comes out naturally in the dialogue without it needing to be signposted, you know.
No, it's good to hear. Right then. Well, look, I will put links in the show notes and information about how people can see the film. And without further ado, we shall move into the second portion of this podcast, which is three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. I'll just quickly run through the rules, as it were, for those that are listening in for the first time. Mikey has given me three movies. We're going to talk about each movie 5 minutes at a time. And at the end of 5 minutes, an alarm will go off to signal the end of that time, and we'll move on to the next one. You could hear that okay at your end, Mikey?
I can, yeah.
Super duper. Well, without further ado, let's start with the first one on your list, which is 1976's Taxi Driver.
Taxi Driver is the film that changed everything for me.
Okay, I'm all ears.
Pretty much. I've always been a film buffin since I was a very young age. My dad sort of had me watching old war movies and westerns and stuff, and I just loved movies growing up as a kid, and I didn't have any aspirations to be a filmmaker. I think maybe at that time I thought acting was the thing. I think as a working class boy growing up in Dundee, you're kind of like, who are my role models? Brian.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Cox is a role model. He's an actor, so, and he's from Dundee. So I was kind of like, maybe acting is the way I want to go. I was into all the classic American movies of the time. I remember seeing The Last Crusade in the cinema in 1989, and that really blew my mind. And I started buying film magazines at that time.
Yeah.
So I started buying Film Review, and I started buying Empire in about 1989, just for showing my age. I was 13 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'd met a few folk at high school as well who also were really into films. And anything film related, I was interested in it at that point. So I was reading Empire. I was reading what all these great films are. And I saw an article in there, like a really short one about Taxi Driver, which was just kind of summing up what it was. And I'd never seen it. But I happened to know that one of my brother's 5 years older than me, and I used to go and meet him at his work. And there was a guy at his work who was really into films, and I'd seen in his bag one day that he had the Cinema Club. I don't know if you remember the Cinema Club VHSs, that there was like a series.
So
they had a series of films, and my brother had bought a few of those, and he had, this guy at his work had Taxi Driver. And because I'd seen it in this magazine, I said to my brother, can you ask him if I can borrow it? Because I'd really like to see it. So. And it destroyed me when I watched it. I mean, I was maybe 14 maybe when I watched it. Far too young to be watching it, probably.
Mm.
I'd seen a lot of horror films and stuff. So I'd seen some pretty tough content by that age. But Taxi Driver was something different. And I wasn't even sure if I liked it when I first saw it. I was just so shell-shocked by it that I couldn't even speak. My brother came into the room and he was like, so what did you think of it then? And I was just like, I was speechless. I was just like, I don't know how to react to this movie. I don't know if I liked it. It's fucked up, man. It's a mental film, you know? And he was like, yeah, it is. But anyway, it became my obsession and I just kind of watched it again because I wanted to see what it was all about. Start to notice the direction of it, which is beautiful, you know? You start to realize this filmmaker's really manipulating me in some very, like, clever ways. It became my obsession. And it, you know, as a people, it became my obsession to such an extent that people used to call me Travis at school.
Oh, wowza. Wowza. Did you go the full mohawk?
I didn't go the full mohawk, but I just wouldn't shut up about it. I was trying to get everyone to watch it. And like loads of my mates were like, Mikey, this film's shit. Like, what are you showing us? This, like, we don't get it. And, but anyway, it just became my obsession. And, you know, and then De Niro became my obsession. I thought I wanted to be an actor. And so then I just started. I'd only seen a couple of films with De Niro before that. I saw The Deer Hunter when I was quite young, which again was a bit of a mind fuck. And I'd seen The Untouchables, which was at that point my favourite film until I saw Taxi Driver. And then, yeah.
It's a while ago now, but can you recall what it was that touched you so deeply then, where you kind of, you knew what you'd had a reaction to, but you weren't even sure whether you liked it or not, like you said, but... What do you remember about any aspects of the film that stands out for you that was part of it?
I think it was just the representation of that, like the masculinity of it, you know, like that fear of loneliness. I mean, I grew up in the country, so I spent a lot of time in my life, like watching films or just hanging about by my, like I wasn't a loner as such because I had lots of friends, but I did spend a lot of time on my own and it gives you lots of time to think. And then when you watch a film that's about this kind of character who's completely disassociated from the life around him in this big city, it really touched me deeply. You know, I was kind of like, holy shit, is this, you know, is this what real loneliness is like? And I was really compelled by that, and obviously I then started to read about Paul Schrader and how he'd written it and how he'd spent time in New York and felt that loneliness. And yeah, it just really, it moved me beyond words.
It was in my second sort of film loving life where I later in life started to get into screenwriting. Taxi Driver was the first screenplay that I read where I realized what the art of the screenplay was.
Yeah,
it was like you can read the screenplay and it's just as beautiful as the film, and you can see how one became the other. It was like one of the first few times where I realized that you could being a good writer could be a screenplay could be that. It doesn't just have to be literally a blueprint to a film. It could be evocative.
Yeah, and it's that great quote from De Niro where he said, "Whether people watch this tomorrow doesn't matter because in 50 years they'll still be watching this movie."
As this conversation is more or less proof.
Yeah. And it's still my favourite film for that reason because it's the one that changed everything for me.
Indeed. Well, look, it's interesting what your second choice is because in a way you could argue that this film, without this film, you don't get Taxi Driver in a way because it was part of that. This is right at the beginning of the new Hollywood that was the 70s that I guess Taxi Driver was one of the peaks. I'm talking about Midnight Cowboy from 1969. Do you want to talk about how you got to see that first time and why that touched you so much?
Okay, so I saw that I taped it off the telly. I was probably about 17 at the time. Mm-hmm. Obviously, having watched Taxi Driver, that opened up a whole new thought about film for me. So then I started to really get deep down into figuring out what it is about 60s and 70s movies that I love so much. And so therefore I had to just take them all in. So I'd found out about Midnight Cowboy, obviously looking back at the Oscars, it had won the Oscar and stuff. I didn't really know that much about it. And I went back just through sort of becoming a bit of a cinephile. I thought that's one of the films that's definitely on my list to see. It was on telly. It was really cool because I'm originally from Dundee. And the Dundee Courier had this really good reviewer who used to put stuff in the paper about what was coming on telly, and they were just like really short little things, but then he did a star rating for them. And I mean, I never met this guy, but the star ratings always, I always agreed with him every time I saw that he'd done something.
Okay. So
he put, Midnight Cowboy was on BBC Two one night, and there was going to be a documentary, a short documentary about it first. And so I taped it all, and he'd given it 5 stars, and I was like, well, I've definitely got to watch this. So, and the same, like, I mean, it's quite similar to Taxi Driver in a lot of ways. It's set in New York. It's about loneliness in New York. It's kind of got real sort of sexual themes running through it. And it just, that kind of film, just, I realized that that's the kind of shit that I wanted to be doing, or that I was interested in. And it's a total gut punch, that film, you know.
Mm.
But funny as well. And I think that that's when I started to realize that, like, the best comedy for me comes through, like, hard drama.
Mm.
I'm not a huge lover of kind of slapstick comedy or comedy that's just a bit sort of thin. I always like comedy that comes out of real life situation where it's potentially a bit depressing.
Yeah, because in Midnight Cowboy, you've got such an absurd setup that really it's like, it's almost like making you look at something over here while you're actually watching a relationship grow.
Yeah.
That's going to really affect you at the end.
And then, you know, from, you know, finding out that it was a British director was also fascinating for me. I was kind
of,
like,
I thought of that, yeah.
Despite the fact that he's like, you know, a gay Jewish guy from Tottenham or wherever, North London somewhere, I think he was originally from. That's such a world apart from what I am. But you start to realize as a young person that you do have really similar thoughts and really similar opinions to people who you're completely disconnected from, you know?
But I suppose in a way it speaks to, I mean, there's a universal truth to being new in town, isn't there? And being lost.
Course,
I mean,
yeah.
That's something you don't have to have even done it. You can relate to it, because those that don't do it are fearful of it happening, and those that have experienced it know exactly what it is when they see it.
Yeah. But I think, like, I'm a small country boy. So I think that maybe growing up, you don't realize that people have the same mindset, if you'll excuse the pun. I was just at that age where I was very impressionable. And it's kind of like when you realize that there's someone at the far side of the world who's thinking the same way as you are, you're kind of like, fucking hell, man, this is amazing.
But isn't that the beauty of sort of finding stuff, is that it's like almost like you watch it and you go, you can almost be sensing like, this was made for me, wasn't it? I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, this is a mass media, but you're able to consume it on such a personal level.
That's right.
That you kind of go, this is talking to me, obviously.
Yeah, and this is like the beauty of cinema, isn't it?
That
it talks directly at us sometimes.
Mm.
And, you know, to go back to that period of time where I was so impressionable that, you know, that those things just became a pure obsession. You know, I'm still obsessed by film, but, you know, you've got a much more critical eye as you get older and you start to, you know, you start to realize various other things. So it's very difficult. And I think that, I mean, I often say this, most people's favorite film will be a film that they saw in their most formative years, like between 14 and 18, probably, you know. So, and that's exactly the same for me, because those two films are just,
it's essentially the whole premise of this podcast.
Yeah.
It's the idea, exactly. It's the idea that the memories that we forge in film are when we're sort of most susceptible to it.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad I'm delivering in such a promising manner then for your...
No, it's perfect. No, because I think that's part of what it is. Because I think if we just said, sometimes it can be a Venn diagram of the film that had a lasting impact on me is also my favourite film, but sometimes... films that have an impact on you when you're younger aren't necessarily going to stay with you as your favorite films, but they doesn't make their impact any less.
Yeah.
You know,
I think somebody once, I can't remember who it was, but somebody once said to me, I'm not going to ask you what your favorite film is, Mikey, as a filmmaker. I'm going to ask you what film, if you could put your name on it as director, would you choose?
Oh, wow. And what did you say?
I said Midnight Cowboy.
Oh, wow.
So Taxi Driver is my favorite film, but if I could put my directorial name on any film, it would be Midnight Cowboy. And I think the difference is because in terms of its construction and the manner of the characterizations in it and the comedy through it.
Mm.
I think that that's what I kind of really aspire to more than.
Yeah, well, I think, it was very much that kind of late 60s, early 70s thing, because you look at something like 71, Harold and Maude.
Yeah.
Which,
by the way, was nearly one of my things.
I'm sure it was, because it speaks to the same thing, where it has the absolute absurdist humour, but then it delivers a gut punch of sort of real sadness and about love. You know, it's not pulling any punches at all.
Yeah, having to pull Harold and Maude out of my three was somewhat difficult.
Well, look, I'm glad you did, because that means we can skip a decade or two, so a film I've never been able to talk about before. So I'm excited about this. It's a long time since I've seen it. But your third choice is, that was me being Segway man, is Thomas Vinterberg's Festum from 1998. Do you want to talk about how you come across that film and what made that such a fun film memory for you?
When I was at uni, we did a lot of study about the Dogma movement.
Mm-hmm.
I went to uni from 97 to 2001. So we'd seen, like, me and my mates who were on the course there, and it was talked about on the course was the Dogma movement. And
mm-hmm.
Obviously, as a young aspiring filmmaker at that point, I'd firmly realised by this point in my life that I was going down the route of being a filmmaker, not an actor. So a film like Festin is hugely inspirational because it's shot in such a veritable, cheap way, and yet has like a story that smacks you around the head, you know.
It's just a little bit.
Yeah. So, and I'm like, this is plausible. It's possible to make a film like this. And you know, it took me a long time to get there, but I got back to it and finally made my film in a similar way, you know. So because I was fed up trying to make it on the bigger budget and getting nowhere with it, so. That film really inspired me. And one of the great things about my story with Festin is that a couple of years later, I won a scholarship to go to UCLA and study directing and screenwriting.
Right.
MA, that was my MA. And I got a chance to meet Thomas Vinterberg.
Oh, wow.
Which was cool, because he was in the middle of cutting one of his films in LA at the time. I can't remember which one. It's the one with... Joaquin Phoenix in it, I think. I can't remember what it's called, but he was recutting that because he wasn't happy with the cut of it. So UCLA had managed to get him in to do a talk. And it was kind of like hardly any students showed up to it because not like very few of them knew who he was, you know, which was kind of crazy. So I went into this room. It was my directing tutor, actually, who told me, he said, Thomas Vinterberg's coming in to do a talk. It's actually for the acting school. But I'm going to go because do you want to come with me? And I was like, yeah, totally. Because he knew, I'd already spoke to him about Festin.
Yeah.
I had no idea what Thomas Vinterberg looked like or anything like that. So it was quite funny. I was sitting waiting to go into the room and these two Danish guys show up. And one of them said, could you tell me where room such and such is? And I was like, this is them, right? So I'm sitting there and I says to the older guy, are you Thomas Vinterberg? And this young guy, this tall young guy standing behind said, no, I'm Thomas Vinterberg. Why would you think he was Thomas Vinterberg? And I was just like, because I've seen your films, man. I just thought that you'd be some older guy that, you know, given the maturity that's shown in your films, I just thought that you'd be older. And he said, well, I'm not that young, but he was quite young. So I was just kind of taken aback and shocked by how young and good looking he was. And so anyway, I went into this room and he proceeds to give this talk to 10, 12 students, which blew my mind about screenwriting and the way that he writes stories and the fact that he pulls all the exposition out and that he talks specifically about how he lets his story develop. And he says, you know, what I do is I just put characters on screen. I think about it. I put characters on screen and little cracks begin to appear in their personality where we begin to find out who they really are. And that's the way that I work. And I was just like, I'm sold. That is basically what I want to do.
I mean, that's the magic of screenwriting, isn't it? If you could present somebody who's something and by the end of the film, they're not that. And you've been pulled through the ringer to get that.
Yeah, so And like the reason I chose this film is because it had such a sort of meaningful impact on me, the film, and then to meet the filmmaker personally and for him to explain to me how he wrote his story and why, I was just like, shit, this guy knows what he's about, and I want to make films like that.
I mean, one of the big things about Feston is obviously the big meltdown at the end where the family secret is out. Did he talk at all about how he wrote? Did he write to that, or did that evolve from his cracks emerging? Because thinking about what you said earlier about your own writing style, about the idea of knowing what you're writing to, it would make sense that Feston would come out of knowing what you're writing to.
So I don't remember specifically him talking about theme and stuff, but I started to figure that out for myself, you know, because obviously I then became a student of film, a student of screenwriting. I started to get really serious about screenwriting after that discussion with him, because I just had thought I'm going to be a director, but I've since become a screenwriter who, when I'm writing, I have the mind of a producer when I'm writing now rather than the director. So I'm working from theme, but I'm also working from, is this feasible? And I try and push the director out of my head while I'm screenwriting, because I think it can get you in all sorts of a pickle if you're.
I mean, for me, the memory for me is that I saw Feston at the Corner House in Manchester, which was like the Arts House cinema in the city centre, which has been replaced now by the Mega Complex Home Cinema, which is this wonderful sort of institution, not just a building. Because I wasn't pursuing film at the time, so the whole Dogma thing passed me by. I just got to watch it as the brilliant drama that it was. I wasn't seeing the style as any. I mean, I saw The Idiots as well around this. That'd have been around the same time, wouldn't it? Not long after. Around the same time from Lars von Trier, which is obviously another one of the School of Dogma. So I was familiar with the term, but it wasn't affecting me. Like, now I look at it, I can see the aesthetic, you know, clear as day. But then it was just like this amazing film.
Yeah, and it's shot on a camcorder. Mm. It's like the thing that makes Feston so good is that it, like, for people who watch it who are interested in film, it sort of encourages them that you can shoot your film with any old piece of shit as long as the story's good.
Exactly.
You know?
No, this is
and
true.
Like, and I've always believed that. I mean, I've got students kind of come to me on open days where I work, and they're kind of like, "What kit have you got? You got an Alexa?" And I'm like, "Yeah, but you know, you only need your mobile phone, to be honest. Like, so for now, you're only going to need your mobile phone.
Indeed.
You know, once you get your scripts all polished and stuff. But that, I mean, that's the thing. Story is everything for me, and I'm, you know, hopefully that people will see that in my first feature when they get a chance to watch it.
Brilliant. Well, look, well, thank you for sharing Taxi Driver, Midnight Cowboy, and Feston, the three films that impacted everything in adult life. And thank you for talking us around how Mindset came about. And it just gives me to say thank you very much for joining us on the podcast.
Cheers, man. It's been a pleasure.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. expires April 30th. One-time use only, not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5hourenergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.